This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camaro.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Decibel Geek Podcast. My name is Aaron Camaro. I'm here by myself this week because I can guarantee you right about now, Chris Sinzak is probably out hanging a poster in front of a music venue or putting it under the windshield of a car or hanging one on a lamp post somewhere. Chris is out hitting the streets right now, but man, we've got a great episode lined up for you this week. We're joined by Sandy Gennaro, drummer extraordinaire. Chris and I sat down with him this week, and we have an awesome conversation that covers the gamut of all kinds of different stuff. You know, clearly, we've been stretched a little thin around here lately because of the Rockin' Pod Expo. As we talked about last week, we featured a bunch of great artists and great bands, people that are going to be appearing at the expo. I told you all about the albums you need to bring. And this week, because it's just me, Chris has been so busy. We've all been really busy. Everybody's so excited about the Rockin' Pod Expo that I'm just going to go ahead. We're not going to do a middle break or nothing. You're going to get the whole uncut interview. I'm not even editing. I don't have time for it. Chris don't have time for it. So what you're getting is something sweet and special with all the warts. If somebody farts, you're going to hear it because there's no editing going on in this episode at all. So to get all the talking and all the introductions out of the way at the very beginning, I just got to tell you, I don't have time for Geeks of the Week. I don't have time to even look and see if there's an iTunes review, even though I sure hope there is. We're going to get all back to that next week. When the Rockin' Pod Expo is over, I'm going to feel like a huge weight's been lifted. I know Chris is probably going to sleep for a week. It's going to be pretty wild, but this party is going to be amazing. So let me tell you all about it just one more time, because the next time we sit down together and hang out and talk rock and roll together, the expo is going to be over, and we're going to be back to business as usual. So you guys know all about it. We talked about it last week. The Rockin' Pod Expo right here in Nashville, Tennessee, this Saturday, August 26th, from 11 a.m. till 8 p.m. at the... see, this is funny. I got a website, and I got two different posters. It's at the Music Valley Event Center right here in Nashville. You guys know all the great people that are going to be there. It's brought to you by Bel Air, Ear Peeler, and High Vol Music. All great companies, man. Support them, support them, support them, because they're supporting Rockin' Pod. And of course, more than that even, it's brought to you by you, the Rock and Roll Podcast supporters. Through all the different podcasts that are involved in this, you guys have stepped up and supported this thing, and I would just like to say thank you. You know, on behalf of Chris and every other rock and roll podcast that's coming to Nashville this coming Saturday, thank you for supporting what we're doing. We all work very hard. We try to bring you guys product that you can enjoy every single week, and I'm super glad to know that you guys have our backs. So thank you for that. What are you getting? Over 25 rock podcasts on site. We just talked about them. You guys know the ones that are all going to be there. We went all over all that last week. So many great ones. Many of my favorite podcasts. I'm going to get to meet people for the first time that I've been listening to for a long time now. People I really admire. Some people that I've been on their shows and have never actually met them in person. It's all going to go down this Saturday at the Rockin' Pod Expo. We got the Heavy Metal Parking Lot reunion and screening. We're going to put it up on the big screen. We're going to watch it, and then we're going to bring the guys out and we're going to talk to them about it. We've got the producers panel with Michael Wagner and Kevin Beamish and Toby Wright. Oh man, there's so much to keep track of. That's going to be amazing. Chris and I are going to be up on stage. We're going to give the people in the audience the opportunity to ask these masterminds their deepest secrets and cool stories about working with Motley Crue, Alice in Chains, and Y&T. Why not? It's going to be awesome. You guys can ask them anything you want. Come on down, hang out with us. We got the songwriters panel. I mean, we got... who's all on that? This is... okay, well, you guys know. It's too much. Here's something I will tell you. There's rumors There's rumors that some very, very special guests may show up at this thing. And I've been sworn to secrecy because it's just, if these people show up, oh man, it's going to be amazing. On top of the people that we already know are going to be there, from Kenny Olsen to Gunnar Nelson and the guys from Roxy Blue. And oh, here's something for you. Comedian S, Courtney Cronin Dold, is going to be there. She's going to help me MC some stuff. I thought I'd look her up. You know, she's a comedian lady, right? You know, so she's got to have some stuff on YouTube. I look her up. She's known for doing the Kiss Cruise. And according to YouTube and what I've looked up about her, she's only got one joke. But the joke is awesome. So go to YouTube when you're done listening to this today. Look up Courtney Cronin Dold. And it's on the Kiss Cruise. It's her one joke. It's funny as hell. I love it. If it's the only one, it's good. So, I mean, what more can I tell you guys? You know, I hope many of you are coming. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody. Chris is looking forward to meeting everybody. We're looking forward to having a really, really great time this Saturday at the Rockin' Pod Expo right here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm done. I got nothing more to say. Like I said, we're not taking a break this week in the middle. We're just going to rock it all the way on through to the end because, man, Sandy Gennaro had Chris and I over to his studio this last... Oh, man, it's all a blur. It was a couple of days ago. Rockin' Pod Expo. It'll drive you crazy. Next year, let's do it somewhere else where Chris and I don't have to do all the work. That poor guy, he's doing 10 times as much as I'm doing, and I'm taking the shortcut and not even editing this episode. So let's get to it. Chris and I, right here on the Decibel Geek Podcast, we're proud to bring you our conversation with the one and only Sandy Gennaro.
As a matter of fact, someone emailed me, the musical director for Queenie emailed me today, and he's put together a corporate all-star band.
Really?
And he wants me to do it with Kip Winger playing bass, and he said, Spike Edney, his name is, what artists mm-hmm. do you know that we can maybe get to front this corporate? So one of the artists was Mickey Dolenz.
Right.
I suggested it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we'll see, that would be very cool.
Original music?
No, it's
or like just we play
some of his hits.
Oh, okay.
You gotcha. Know, in a corporate environment.
I got gotcha.
As a special guest, he'd come on and do it.
That's kind of a part of the industry a lot of like regular music fans don't even realize exists.
It's
like
it's under the radar kind of thing, but yeah.
But that's a lot of where your bread comes from.
That's right.
Yeah,
especially what they call the legacy artists.
Yeah,
you know, like the Monkees or you know.
Uh huh.
Sticks even
right
you know, Mark CCR, CCR bands like that.
John Fogerty
yeah
any of those guys but they you know Davey he loved doing corporates because well there was a lot of things he loved about doing corporates was the money was like three times his normal fee and they take care of you with really good food the backstage situation the rider all of everything is provided
yeah
you know top notch transportation back and forth to the hotel or whatever the thing he didn't like about it depending on the corporate gig usually we played after a dinner
mm-hmm.
so a lot of times you know this people were cleaning up the dishes from what we're doing.
That's got to be a little awkward.
Or something. Clean it up.
That's not the reaction I hoped for.
But that's the only thing. And that didn't happen every corporate. It happened some corporates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was great. You know, doing those things are great. And people are making a living. That, between corporate and Indian casinos all over America.
Yeah,
they're keeping people alive, basically.
Absolutely.
Keeping the lights on in a lot of these people's houses. So.
Yeah.
Bless the Mohican Sun.
That's right. Yeah. You know? You can still do it at the age a lot of them are, you know.
Yeah.
All the power to them.
But, and that's kind of with the industry changing, and it's more out there about the casino gigs and stuff. Like, everybody does those now, right?
Right?
Especially the heritage artists. But, or like having songs in commercials. Like,
right.
Used to be the kiss of death for credibility. Now it's like,
now
you're happy to have that.
Right.
Yeah. That's like a badge of honor getting, mm-hmm. you know, songs in a commercial.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so we're on now.
Yeah, we're
going. Oh, that's awesome.
That's the way we do our interviews.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I love it.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, we just talk. You know, we're there's awesome. No set script. I mean, I might refer to my phone a little bit, but...
Yeah, I mean, ask any...
I think I read an old interview with you from a long time ago, and I think one of the things that stood out to me was that I think your dream before drumming was to be a Major League Baseball player.
Ah, yes. I played baseball all the way through the second year of college. Mm-hmm. I played second base, and I usually batted somewhere at the top of the order because I was fast, but I didn't have much power. I was always like this big.
Yeah.
So two things happened. Well, I came to the realization of two things. At the same time, when I started college, actually the third and fourth year of high school, junior, senior high school, I started playing clubs and stuff. When it got to be college, I started playing more clubs, like mm-hmm. 2 a.m. And a lot of times I had to, usually those gigs were on weekends, and a lot of times I had to get up on a Saturday morning and practice baseball. And when it was baseball season, it got to be a little bit too much. I was either hungover or tired or... you know, whatever. And then from being up that early, I had to go to 2 a.m. that night, you know. So Oof. It got to be where I had to choose. And then looking in the mirror, I'm going, well, I'm a junior, sophomore in high school, and I'm 146 pounds. Man, I don't think I'm going to grow anymore. So I really wanted to play for the Yankees. That was my dream. And still, I'm a huge fan. And,
yeah.
So that put this kibosh on it. I had to make a choice. But... you know, drumming was always the realistic goal.
Right.
You know, the Yankees was a lofty goal. But if I was, 6'6 and 220 pounds, I might have given it a shot because I thought I had the ability to at least try it.
Yeah.
You know, to try to go on behind college and try, whatever this system is. You know.
Sure.
But yeah, I still, if it wasn't for Major League Baseball, MLB.tv, I probably wouldn't have moved to Nashville.
Oh, so you can stay in touch with the game.
Yankee games.
Yeah.
I get all the Major League games all over America.
Yeah.
You know, if it's everything except Atlanta when they play, but who wants it? Who wants to watch the Braves anyway?
Hey, now. I grew up a Braves fan in Atlanta.
They're just sorry, man.
Come on, now.
So that was
we should be at odds because, like, my dad grew up in Milwaukee, and he was there in 57 and 58 when the Braves and the Yankees went back and
Eddie
forth.
Eddie Matthews and all that, right.
Yeah, he was buddies with Johnny Logan's son, and they would hang out in the dugout at County Stadium.
Awesome.
But he's like, I remember Hank Aaron when he was 23. And
right.
I'm like, gosh.
Wow,
I was like, what was he like? Quiet. He's like, he never talked.
Right.
But I guess you were in New York when the 77, when the whole...
As a matter of fact, I wasn't in New York.
Oh, you weren't?
I happened to be in Los Angeles. I lived in Los Angeles from 76 to 79.
So you missed the summer of Sam that went down with David Berkowitz.
I missed that, but more importantly...
And the Yankees?
Dodgers.
Oh, okay.
I think it was the Dodgers, the World Series. That was 2 years in a row, I think, 77, 78, or 78, 79, or whatever. And I was living in L.A.
Oh, okay.
So I would wear my Yankee swag every single day, just to
right.
Because I wasn't a big fan of L.A. anyway, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I think that one of those World Series was Reggie's 3 homers,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, Mr. October.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a lot of baseball stories, a lot of that I ended up through David Fischoff, who put the Monkees on the road originally.
Mm-hmm.
He originally, before he was the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp CEO, he became, at that point in time, he was a promoter that put the Monkees on the road, and he also handled sports stars. He was a sports agent.
Yeah.
And he handled Phil Simms of the Giants, quarterback for the Giants, and he also handled... Randy Myers, who was a closer for the Mets at the time.
Yeah, good pitcher.
So Monkees were on the road. Randy was a big baseball fan. He came to some gigs and whatever. We became friends because I was like a fan, you know. Even though I'm a Yankee fan, I root for the Mets when they're not playing the Yankees.
Right.
Because they're a New York team, and I don't dislike them.
Right.
And we ended up partying at China Club in New York when he was in town. And, you know, after 3 or 4 beers... Hey, did you ever play baseball, Sandy? And I go, yeah, I told the story. I played in college. He goes, yeah, I bet you can't hit anymore. I said, I bet you I can. I go to the batting cage up the road here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just for fun, me and my daughter hit some balls, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, yeah, long story short, he goes, yeah, I bet you can't hit it. And I said, I bet you I can. I bet you a case of beer I can. And he goes, all right, I'm going to take you up on it. I go, yeah, right, Randy, you're right. And so he called me like 2 days later. He goes, I got permission to have you come up.
What?
To take batting practice at Shea Stadium. I have pictures.
Wow.
So I went up there with my wife and a photographer, a video guy, and he got the Bat Boys uniform for me. I put the Bat Boys uniform on, and it was starting to rain on the field, so we took batting practice in a cage underneath the old Shea Stadium. And he was pitching, you know, he was pitching like 70, 80, and I was hitting him, fouling him off or whatever. And I said, all right, you know, kick it up a couple of notches. And he kicked it up to about 80. He said his estimation was 80, 82, whatever. Mm-hmm. I was fouling him off. And then he threw me, I said, let me see what a slider looks like. And he threw me a slider. And I'll tell you what, it's amazing how these guys hit major league pitching. Because it starts out, it looks like it's going to hit you in the head. And it ends up on the outside corner of the plate. You know, it was like.
Yeah, it's like a magic trick.
So anyway, we did that for about 20 minutes. And he goes, Sandy, I got to get ready for the game or whatever. I go, all right, Randy, before you go, just throw one, air it out.
Yeah.
I want to see what 90, 92 feels like. And I said, I'm not going to swing. I just stood there and I watched, and I felt what 92 mile an hour fastball feels like. It was like it cuts air.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It actually cuts air. And you hear it go past you. And you have to react like as
when
soon
it's in his hand.
When you talk about release point, how important it is, and I'm going, how important could release point be? You got to watch the ball and hit it. Mm-hmm. But it is very important because as soon as that ball, if you suspect a fastball, and like if the count is like 3-1 or something, and the guy's got to come in or a strike, and usually it's a fastball, you have to react as soon as the ball leaves your hand, or else it's by you. It's by you.
So it's more guessing where the ball's going to be when you swing.
It's not guessing where the ball's going to be. It's guessing what kind of pitch is coming.
Right? Yeah.
So it's a fastball, you know, and a lot depends on the count. If you have two strikes on you and no balls, then you're in trouble because it could be.
Yeah.
They could deliberately throw it out of the strike zone or whatever, but it's all about guessing what pitch is coming, because that's gonna determine the velocity of the pitch, and also you have to take into account the count that you're in, because that will determine how bad he needs to come in for a strike, which would determine what kind of pitch he pitches. So baseball is a big mind game.
Yeah,
it's like chess, man.
It's
just freaking awesome, and it's my favorite sport to watch on TV. As a matter of fact, it's the only sport I watch on TV during the regular season.
Right.
I don't watch football until the playoffs, maybe.
Right.
If there's a New York team, I will. But But yeah, that was my experience. And then again, through David Fischoff, I met the head of public relations with the Yankees and befriended him. I made sure I was friends with these guys that came to these gigs.
Yeah, sure.
Oh yeah, if you don't want to come to the game. Now, not like rewind. Well, all right, that was rewind the clock to when I was with Joan Jett, 1988, 89, 90. I saw on the itinerary that we're going to Evansville, Indiana, which is the off-season home of Don Mattingly, who used to play with the Yankees. And I called Kenny Lagona, Jones' manager, immediately. I said, Kenny, I know you're a Yankee fan too. We're going to Don Mattingly's hometown. See, he goes, I'll try to hook it up. Called me back a few days later, saying, I got good news and bad news. What's the bad news? I was unable to contact through the Yankees office Don Mattingly. What's the good news? Well, Don Mattingly called the office. And he's a big fan of Joan Jett. He wants to come to the show.
Nice.
Awesome. So he comes to the show, and he comes backstage, and I'm like a little kid. Like, I'm like a little, literally, I was like a little kid. This is Don Mattingly.
Yeah,
I was
right?
watching, it was off season, but it was 19.
He was at his peak at that period, right? Late 80s.
It was like the MVP or something. He was in his prime.
Yeah, he was
in his
great.
Prime. He was a hitting, batting champion. I mean, won the batting title 1 year or whatever. And so he came, and he says to his wife, "Hey Kim, take those little airline bottles out of here." So he pulled these little bottles of Jack Daniels and mixed them with Coke. And then we were warming up, getting ready to go on, and he pulls his harp out, and we ended up having a little impromptu jam session. Like Ricky Bird played guitar and unplugged or whatever, and he was playing harp, and I was playing.
Wow.
He plays harp, and he's a very big blues fan. We found out. So anyway,
wow.
He's on the side of the stage at the gig, and he's feeling no pain at that moment, and he's air drumming to And I'm going, wait a minute, this don't matter. Air drumming to my. Dancing on the side of the stage. He invited us all to his restaurant. He had a sports bar in town. He invited us all to his restaurant. I made sure I jockeyed. I was walking in right behind. I was following him. So wherever he sat, I made sure. There was a big table set up with napkins and glassware and all of that, tablecloth or whatever, long table for the band, the crew. And I sat right next to him. So we spoke all night. And he was loaded with questions about, like, touring and what's a rock and roll league. Just as I was with baseball.
Yeah.
Those guys are really curious about the rock and roll lifestyle and all of that and the backstage situation, you know, whether chicks, whatever. So he gave me his card. He goes, "Here, this is the house I when I play during the season. I live in Englewood, New Jersey. Here's my number, and you know, if you ever want to go to a game." So it ended up that I ended up at Yankee Stadium as Don Mattingly's guest.
Wow.
More than once, and I was led to the runway outside the dressing room, and As a thank you, I had at that point in time I had a Ray-Ban endorsement, so I brought a bunch of Ray-Ban sunglasses, some Joan Jett swag, some whatever. So I met him outside. We had the meet and greet. Meanwhile, it was all being videotaped and whatever. So I went back on a couple of different occasions. Now fast forward a couple of years, and then I then went to Boston to see them. Don Mattingly got me on the list. I went to Baltimore to see them. Don Mattingly got me on the list. It was awesome. It was a vacation for my wife and I. Every year we used to go to a stay the weekend or whatever if the Yankees were playing it. Now fast forward to somewhere in the late 90s, and I met the head of public relations through David Fischoff. He came to a Monkees gig, and he said, "If you ever want to go to a game." So, okay, fine. His name is Joe Pellegrino. And so I'm watching TV, I'm watching the YES Network, and watching the Yankee game, and during an ad, a commercial, I saw a commercial with Bernie Williams playing guitar and Paul O'Neill playing the drums. I'm going, that's cool. Paul O'Neill's a drummer. It's cool. And they were advertising the Yankee broadcast or something, or a giveaway day or something. So I contacted Mr. Pellegrino. And I said, "Hey, Mr. Pellegrino, see if Paul would like to, I would like to meet Paul. I'm a drummer. Tell him I play with the Monkees. And if there was any... if there's anything I can bring him drum-wise, some heads or press." So he got back to me. He says, "Yeah, Paul would love to meet you. His kids are big young Monkee fans. If he can bring some Monkee swag, that would be awesome." So I brought some Monkee swag. Now, this time, I brought my wife and my kid, and we're in the dugout. It was a day game, 11 o'clock in the morning. We're in the dugout, and Joe Torre, everybody's coming, the players, nobody's in the park except the employees, and they're coming out with this, with their like knee-length skivvies and flip-flops and all of that. And Pellegrino comes down and says, "Okay, Sandy, come with me, but your wife has to bring your swag with you, but your wife and kid have to stay here. Mariano will take them." Mariano Rivera. It's like kibitzing with my kid. I got pictures of that too. So I walk down. Now I'm down the runway. And now I'm in the aisle outside the dressing room where I used to hang with Mattingly. And I stopped there. There's two guards at the dressing room door. The dressing room door opens. Pellegrino walks in, turns around, goes, "Come on." I go, "The dressing room? The locker room?"
Yeah,
"Come on. Just no pictures. I'll take pictures of you and Paul when we get them." But so I walk in, and I'm in the, I get the sense of... You don't have any idea the magnitude of my heart was pounding out of my chest. I am in
the
locker. It's like a priest. It's like a priest going to see the Pope.
Yeah.
I swear to God, it's like I'm picturing the plastic over the lockers, the champagne being sprayed.
Right.
I'm seeing Tino Martinez. It's freaking what amounts to be underwear.
Yeah.
It's under the uniform clothes.
Right.
And D. Jeter, Mariano Rivera, all these guys. So anyway, he goes, "Wait here, I'll go get Paul." And Paul came out. I met Paul O'Neill, was standing in front of his locker, and I gave him all the swag, and he signed a bunch of stuff, posed for pictures. "Thank you very much,
That's
Sandy,"
awesome.
Whatever. Yeah, it was I'll never forget that experience.
Nice.
And I have pictures to vouch for.
That's awesome.
That's super cool.
See, there's a bunch of other baseball stories.
Yeah, I know. So we're turning into sports podcast.
We don't want to.
But I love baseball too, so I could listen to that all day. Well, growing up, becoming a drummer, who influenced you as a drummer?
Well, right off the bat, Ringo. I was always attracted to the early British guys. Ringo was number one, always. But then guys like Dave Clark, I really liked those, you know, I love the drum sound on his record, even though later on I found out it wasn't even Dave Clark playing drums on the record.
Really?
No, it was a studio guy.
Didn't know that. Dave Clark
produced those records, Glad All Over, Bits and Pieces and all that, but there was a British studio guy that played on he was like Britain's Hal Blaine.
He played on all the pop stuff. Huh.
All the pop, like Herman's, all that stuff, Freddie and the Dreamers, all that stuff.
But
Dave Clark, then later on when Zeppelin came out, obviously John Bonham and Keith Moon. I didn't try to emulate Keith Moon because his style, I just loved his character more than his drumming style. But John Bonham, you know, and Ringo, I guess, are the two major guys.
Well, with Keith Moon, I think one of my favorite descriptions of The Who was four guys that are all playing their own song.
Like
they're all playing a solo in the same song.
Correct.
They really were.
That's the way it was.
Yeah.
So did you get to see the Beatles when they were on Ed Sullivan?
Of course.
Where it all started for you?
Well, yeah, that's basically where it started. I started playing about a year later, but that kind of lit the fire.
Yeah.
That lit the fire, and about a year later, I think that was February of 64, and about a year later, I got my first drum set.
Wow.
And it was, I just stood at it. We brought it home, and I just set it up, and I just looked at it. Couldn't believe that I basically had my own drum set.
Yes.
But my mom says that, my mom, rest of the soul, told me that even from the age of three, I got a toy little drum at the age of three, and she gave me pictures of me playing it beneath the Christmas tree and whatever. And I was always attracted to rhythm, like the butter knife on the table, like a nice little action the butter knife had. And then when it came time, I saw a snare drum in a friend of mine's closet. We went to retrieve a spare softball. We lost a softball, and I went nuts. And I asked him if I can borrow it. And he said, I have to ask my dad. He brought it home over that night. I borrowed the snare drum. My mother said, okay, just go in and play it, but just put a towel over it so don't make that noise. So I put it on the coffee table in the living room with a towel. And on the Victrola, which was the record player, I put some 45s on, like Surf and Bird and New Orleans by Gary U.S. Bonds were the first couple of songs I played. Let There Be Drums, Sandy Nelson. And then when it was time to give the drum back, I was in tears, obviously, and my mom said, well, save your allowance and we'll get you a drum set if you really want it. Let's see how much you really want it. Save your allowance. And I did that, and I didn't have enough to buy the drum set, but she brought me to Manhattan. We picked out a drum set. It was 1965.
Cool.
Awesome.
And it was that was the beginning of the half a century journey. And I'm still
You're still waiting to grow out of this phase, huh?
I'm still wondering what I'm going to be when I grow up.
Oh, man. So I'm guessing you were playing the club circuit in New York through the early 70s. When the Dolls and the Ramones and all that was going on?
Yeah, yeah. It was, I started playing clubs and stuff in like 66, 67. That's when I was like a sophomore in high school. I'm giving my age away. Graduated high school in 69. So, yeah, it's all through the early 70s.
That era.
69, 72. Yeah. And then I kind of did a cover band road gig. I was based out of Scranton. I did that. And then I went on the road with a band in like the 73, playing covers 4 or 5 sets a night, 9 o'clock to 2 in the morning, 40 on, 20 off, all over the Midwest, like Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and that area for about 6 or 7 months, playing five nights, sometimes six, 9 to 2. And all covers, and with a guitar player that had a Marshall stack, they were at the beginning of their and SVT, but we weren't at the point yet of miking drums.
Okay,
so I had to compete with Marshalls and SVTs with no mic.
That's where it comes from.
5-6 hours a night.
Well, because we first saw you at the Dick Wagner show at Basement.
That was amazing.
That was what drew us. Was like, God, Sandy beats the hell out of the drums.
I was on like maybe 5.
Oh my god. Out of 10.
Well, that was the room.
It's a small room.
Small room, low ceiling.
Yeah.
Everything is mic'd from what I recall, so yeah. I didn't really have to hit that hard.
It was, but it looked like you were just beating them to death. Maybe your style.
And that was really good. That was one of my first gigs in Nashville when I moved to after I moved to.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and then I did the Dick Wagner benefits the last two.
How did you meet up with him to start with?
Good question. The guitar player in that Dick Wagner situation was Kirk McKim, right. who I played with, was playing with at the time with Pat Travers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Kirk knew someone that was contacted by Dick Wagner's manager, Susan Michelson.
Yep.
And Dick Wagner had just written a book and he was on a mm-hmm. book tour. Yep. And every stop on the book tour, he used to play a couple of tunes and sometimes unplugged. But when there was an availability of having a band, he would do it. And yeah. the Grimes was perfect. Yep. The book signing upstairs and the basement downstairs. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so this guy contacted Kirk. Mm-hmm. Susan contacted this guy, Shelley Farrell.
Yeah, Shelley Farrell.
And that's where we rehearsed, Shelley's place.
Yeah.
And then Shelley contacted Kirk and Dave Fowler was the bass player.
Yeah, great bass player.
And so Kirk contacted me. We have Dave Fowler, me, Sandy, you want to play it? Dick Wagner? Sure.
Yeah.
So we rehearsed at Shelley's like two days, like five, six songs, well, however many songs we did. And then we played the basement. And it was amazing because I didn't know that much about Dick Wagner, but once we started talking and then I read his book, we know so many people in comedy, spent a lot of time in New York, whatever. So that was really good.
Well, he's one of those under the radar guys, mostly known for studio work.
Right.
And like you don't realize, then you look at his resume, like, oh my God, he was a part of a lot of huge stuff.
Part of a lot of stuff that he wasn't on the contract, he wasn't given credit for because he shadow played on a bunch of records. So, it was good. And I had a really nice long phone conversation with him maybe a few weeks before he passed away.
Yeah.
It was awesome. And then I was honored to be the drummer in the Dick Wagner Memorial Concerts in Detroit that they have every year.
Yeah. And those seem to have done really well since they started.
I'm hoping that there's going to... I haven't heard anything about this year. Usually they're in January, February in Detroit.
Okay. Yeah.
And Susan likes to put the date in place and start corralling a musician. I haven't heard anything about this year, so about 18. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we interviewed him around that time when he was in town, and Susan was just awesome.
She's a great
human.
Definitely.
But that's cool. All right, well, I wanted to ask you about that. But the 70s, that 70s era of New York is just fascinating to me. And
sure.
The music scene just seemed magical at that time.
It's one of those things, and you probably have your own experience in your own life. While you're going through a scenario or a situation or a time period, like you mentioned, the early 70s in New York, especially New York City, especially Manhattan, especially the Village, you don't realize the impact is going to have later on. You don't realize how magnificent that time period is because you're living
in it.
And then when you step out, when time allows you to look back on it, it's totally amazing. There's several periods of my life where I'm like, wow, I lived through that.
Yeah.
It's just just going to see the Dolls and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to go to Max's Kansas City and the Fillmore East almost every single weekend because they had the same bands there Friday and Saturday. So if you didn't go Friday, you didn't went Saturday. And $2.50 buys you a ticket, and you're seeing Led Zeppelin open for Iron Butterfly. You're seeing Jeff Beck Group with Rod Stewart's first tour of America. You're seeing Cream. You're seeing Jethro Tull, which I wasn't a big fan of, but you're seeing Faces later on. You're seeing, you know, just the list 10 years after, The Dead, the Allman Brothers, all these people for $2.50. If you want to spring for $3.50, you get the orchestra, but $2.50 gets you in the building.
That's
and then
wild.
You sit in the balcony. But, and then around the corner was the Electric Circus. So you might have Led Zeppelin, Opeth, Iron Butterfly in any given weekend. Around the corner, the Electric Circus at St. Mark's Place, you might have Sly and the Family Stone playing there, you know, six nights or something, and it was just great. And one little quick little antidote. We used to go to this place on Bleecker Street next to the Bitter End called Nobody's. It was just a bar, and with a great jukebox. And we were leaning next to you. We used to have a couple of beers there and then walk over to Max's or go to the Fillmore or whatever. And me and my friends are leaning on against the jukebox, and all of a sudden we see a white Corvette pull up, and it was like a storefront kind of thing, so you could see the curb and stuff outside. Mm-hmm. And it was a small little place. And out jumps, this has had to be 69, something like that, out comes Jimi. Jimi with an I.
Hendrix.
Wow.
With the hat.
The full getup.
The full stage regalia. He had the boa on, and he had a beautiful blonde sitting next to him in the Corvette. He double parks, gets out, velvet whale bottoms, walks out, walks to the back of nobody's, and picks up the payphone, makes a quick payphone call, hangs up, and walks back out, and nobody's gets in his car, drives away.
And everyone's like with their jaw on the floor.
But this is, you know, this is early in Jimmy's career. So if you were a musician and were hip to Fire and Purple Haze, which were the two songs that were playing on FM radio, you knew who he was. But a lot of people didn't really, in that bar at that moment, didn't really know who he was, but me and my buddies. And
wow.
It was awesome. Nice. But that's the kind of thing you find. And mm-hmm. you know, the Village was just magical. It was just, you know, I'm thinking about it now. It was just a great time to grow up. And I'm really fortunate having grown up when I did, mm-hmm. you know, born when I did. It was really cool. It was so different than it is now. So.
Do you like? Let me run a couple of venue names by and see if what you... Do you remember the Hotel Diplomat?
Oh, yeah. I didn't go there. I've heard of it in shows there all the time. Was Mercy Arts Center part of
Mercer
that?
Arts Center?
The Mercer. I think of the Mercy Lounge. Mercer Arts Center. Was that part of Hotel Diplomat?
I think it was a separate venue.
I used to go to Mercer Lounge all the time.
Hotel Diplomat's famous for being where Kiss kind of got their start.
I saw Kiss, I think, probably before the Hotel Diplomat at a place called the Coventry.
You saw them at the Coventry?
In Queens.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And their makeup, and I don't know if this is true. Uh-huh. I should find out. They used to put the makeup, they used to burn the cork out of a wine bottle, the mm-hmm. cork, and burn it over a fire. Mm-hmm. And then that's how they applied the black makeup on their face.
Really?
Rumor has it. I don't know for sure. But and that's how we used to, when I was a hobo at Halloween, that's how you put the black face on it. Whatever.
That's wild.
Yeah. And then I went on to become pretty close friends with Paul.
Oh,
and
did
now,
you?
Now Eric and Bruce Kulick, I played in the band with.
Yeah, we're gonna get to that. Yeah. Tell me about Kiss at the Coventry. What did you think of them then?
It was kind of raw. They were very, 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 very loud. And they played, you know, some of the songs off the first record, which, you know, cool tunes. I remember it was being really, really cool. And I remember walking out of there going, man, that's different.
Yeah.
You know, whether that people love them or hate them, they were going to be noticed and command opinion from everybody. And back then it was, they were kind of taking, you know, more of a femme, mm-hmm. like a glam.
Right, mm-hmm. kind of like the Dolls.
Correct, because they went to see the Dolls at Mercer Arts Center, like New Year's Eve or something, mm-hmm. or at the Palladium, or somewhere, I just went to see them, Bill of Coin's suggestion, and they saw how the Dolls, and they tried to cop that vibe, and then Bill of Coin had a partner that was heavily into fashion.
Sean Delaney.
What's his name?
Sean Delaney.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you know more than I do.
We're Kiss nerds. But you were there. We weren't. That's why I want your recollection.
Yeah, so, yes. And they, and the, what's his name
again? Sean Delaney.
Sean Delaney had a lot to do with putting them in the leather and more of a metal-y, study, hard rock thing as opposed to a glam thing.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of Bill of Coin stories which go untold right now. Between when he was managing Billy Idol. It's a Studio 54 kind of thing. You know?
Okay.
Yeah. I
can read between the lines. I've heard stories from Bill. Well, we have a...
He was awesome. Yeah. But let me put it this way. He was very, very respectful of me. You know what I mean? He respected my... what I wanted to do, more importantly, what I didn't want to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he wanted me to play in Billy Idol's band.
Yeah.
Back when Rebel Yell was White Wedding or something.
Yeah.
He had me up to his place to listen to the demos or whatever. And, it was cool. It was good. Bill was cool.
We have a mutual friend in Cher Bach who was part of the whole scene. And she had stories about Bill and
she was here. She was here taking a drum lesson.
I saw the Facebook post, so she's taking up drums now.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool.
I didn't see that post yet, but
yeah, she posted about
it. So I went on, speaking of Kiss, I went on to become friends with Paul Stanley.
Yeah.
And we went to Eric Carr's funeral together.
Oh, you did?
In Middletown. Yeah, me, Paul Stanley and I has a mutual friend named Bobby Held, and of course Bruce Kulick.
Mm-hmm.
So Bobby asked me, hey, would you mind taking me and Paul up to Middletown? Town, which is where Eric's funeral was. So subsequently Paul and I used to come to clubs, and we used to be at the China Club. We found ourselves on a jam situation on stage very, very often.
Oh, okay.
And then I met Ace through Anton Figg.
Yeah.
Anton Figg played on, as you know, he played on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm good friends with him. I hate to be dropping names, but this is the connection. But
we love stories about Anton Figg and Paul Stanley and all these guys.
Anton was awesome, and he's still a very good friend. And he called me one day. He goes, hey man, I know you like the Kiss stuff, and you met Ace informally a couple of times, and I called him and he said it would be okay for me to ask you to go up there. Usually he just likes me to go up there every once in a while and play. We pushed the record. Mm-hmm. John Reagan, the bass player at the time, was, I think it was with Frampton.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, John goes, yeah, I can't make it today, Stanley. You want to go ahead and I think there's a drum set up there or whatever. It's Connecticut when he put Ace lived in Connecticut. So sure. So I went up there and put the, and that's where I put
the tape. Oh, was this at the underground studio?
No. It was an above ground studio, but it was kind of separate. It was connected to the main house by a little breezeway.
Yeah. Okay. That's the one in Wilton. I
don't remember what it was, but it was a short drive from Manhattan. It wasn't that far. And so that's where me and Ace really bonded. And then we used to run into each other at Studio 54. That's another venue further uptown, 54th Street, but that was another venue where in the late 70s, uh-huh, early 80s, was classic.
You hung out with Ace Frehley at Studio 54?
I can only imagine
what was going down.
It was just... it was a little R-rated, so to speak, in the substance area. But he has the most outrageous laugh in rock and roll, and so we became really good friends as a result of me going to his house. But then we used to hang out and meet each other, and then he ended up being a guest at some fantasy camp.
Mm-hmm.
So we crossed paths on many occasions. Most recently was at the Rock Legends cruise, mm-hmm, about 2 years ago. He appeared. And a good friend of mine, Richie Scarlett, was playing with. So it was like, the older you get and the longer you stay in this business, it's, mm-hmm, like, it's like a pyramid.
Yeah.
The circle gets smaller as you go on in time, not as you get higher, but as you, and you stay in the business because it's like a serendipity.
Yeah, there's all these connections.
It's like all the connections.
Yeah.
You have no idea. You really have no idea where things are going to come from or who they're going to come from. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's awesome. It's just awesome.
Keep it in mind that we don't have a problem being an R-rated show. Do you have any cool Ace Frehley party stories that you can't tell us?
No, I'd rather not. I'd rather not go. That's a little private little thing, but not really. You could use your imagination.
Yeah,
there's nothing really out of the ordinary that would be out of what you wouldn't imagine.
And for you listeners, listen to the Joe Renda episode.
Yeah, no kidding.
Did you ever know Joe Renda?
I heard.
He owned, I think it was called North Lake Studio up in... White Plains, I think.
Okay.
Ace used to hang out with him all the time, and he was actually the guy who discovered the Jerky Boys.
Oh.
So, but yeah, he's a... Cool. But he had a million Ace Frehley stories.
So on that cruise, on that Travers cruise where Ace was... No, actually, I'm thinking of another cruise. We did... One of the last cruises I did with Travers was the Kiss cruise.
Uh-huh.
And obviously it was Tommy Thayer and Eric. And I know Eric for... a long time from Badlands.
Love that,
because Paul O'Neill managed Badlands. He's the guy in Trans-Siberian Orchestra now, Paul O'Neill.
Right.
From he used to play in a band called Savatage.
That's right. Yep.
So it's the network is the roots of that tree go deep. So it was cool when Travers did their show, and the audience was Doc, who I know, Doc McGee.
Yeah.
For years, he managed the producer that produced Benny Mardonis's record.
Right.
Barry Mraz, his name is. This is before Doc handled any rock and roll bands. He handled a local band in Florida called Night Flight or something.
Mm-hmm.
But this is before he got into rock and roll, basically. He handled the producer. And that's when I met Doc, and we became friends, and we still are friends.
Wow, you've known him that far back.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
1980.
Wow, you've done him longer than just about everybody.
1980, and I was kind of in acquaintance with him when he signed Bon Jovi,
yeah.
He signed Motley Crue, blah, 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 all that stuff. And
yeah.
All that. So, so he was on the cruise with Kiss, obviously. So they were all seeing Travis. This is like 2015.
Yeah.
And, it was very cool. And then Eric came and sat in on a song.
Uh-huh.
And I stayed on the drums, and Tommy Thayer came and sat in on Statesboro Blues.
Okay.
With me and Travis and Rodney, the bass player. And then Eric came up and sat in on a song with Travers.
Wow.
And Paul was there, and Doc was there, and Gene wasn't at that gig, at the RL gig,
mm-hmm.
but Tommy,
that's
Eric,
a trip.
And Paul were there. And Paul's son.
Evan.
Yeah. He sat in with us, too.
That's crazy.
Right on.
He's playing here in town on Sunday, his band.
So if you turn around...
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture of Peter Chris.
Yeah, sure is.
And Doc called me, I forget what year it was, but when Peter was back in the band with the makeup on, with Ace,
when they
reunited with the makeup on,
yeah.
They did an, you probably know this being Kiss fans, they did an Unplugged with the Australian Symphony.
Yeah, I was going to, because Kirk McKim told me to ask you about this story. That you were brought in to help him.
Yeah. Well, Paul, what it was, they were planning on doing it with a gig with the Australian Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Stanley wanted to do a lot of songs that weren't actually Kiss songs, but there were songs that he wrote,
mm-hmm.
and he had demos of the songs with Eric Singer playing on the demos.
Oh, okay.
Okay? So Doc calls me, explains the situation. He goes, would you mind going over, because I know you teach, and it's one of my things.
Yeah.
Would you mind going over to Peter's house in Jersey with the drum set, and I'll send you the songs. Just give Peter, with all due respect, I love Peter Chris, mm-hmm. but he's not a drummer's drummer. In other words, Eric Singer played some parts mm-hmm. that I kind of had to digest.
Mm-hmm.
For Peter, and
right.
give him a reasonable facsimile of that beat or that fill or that part,
right.
to be for him to execute the song. So, a couple of conference calls, and Peter was feeling me out or whatever, and I showed up at his house with a drum set and a metronome and all the songs. I had all the songs and two sets of headphones or whatever. And so I did that. It was the first 15 minutes were a little bit icy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Sure. But he saw that I was an Italian, number one.
Yeah.
And I was from New York City, and I was the age I was, so I grew up in that period of the Coventry. I mentioned the Coventry.
Yeah, you saw him when he was 20
right,
or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So the walls came down.
Yeah.
And he showed me around his house and Brick Township and his wife Gigi.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. And talking and set up my drums up, and we set up two drum sets similar to this. And he goes, Don't think you're going to fucking teach me how to play Kiss songs. I've been playing them for 30 years. I go, don't worry. No, this is not about that. But it was very, very successful. I don't have to go into detail about the songs or whatever.
Right.
But it was very, very successful. He loved it. I went over there three times a week for about 3 weeks, 2 hours, 2.5 hours at a clip. So it was like 6-7 hours a week or something
mm-hmm.
for 2 or 3 weeks. And called me from Australia. He goes, oh, Sandy, man, it went fucking awesome. It went really good. Oh, awesome. So then they end up on that following tour. They toured with Aerosmith.
Yeah,
they opened for Aerosmith.
Right.
And I went to see him at PNC Bank Center in New Jersey as Peter's guest, and went backstage afterwards. And, you know, they come out in the makeup after.
Yeah.
And then the full, they, you know, Gene, after the blood and everything, he goes and remakes up for the meet and greet for Kiss Army.
Well, that's cool.
Because they, you know, the guys paid $1,000, $1,500.
Sure. Yeah.
Next. So, Peter, of course, Paul was there, and Tommy Thayer was there, and I kind of knew those guys, but I never really actually met Gene before. And at this point in time, this is before the cruise we did with Kiss.
Right.
And so Peter brings me over to Gene, I introduce him, and then Peter walks off or is talking to my wife or something, and Gene leans over and goes, thank you very much, man. I really appreciate you working with Peter like that. I go, man, no big deal. He goes, that was one of the first time in years when we went into rehearsal for that Australian gig. He goes, that was one of the first times in years Peter came prepared. Mm-hmm. He says usually he puts his sticks down after the last show of a tour and doesn't pick the sticks up until the first day of rehearsal. Mm-hmm. So it takes him 3 or 4 rehearsals to at least get the cobwebs and brush the dust off his muscles and stuff. Yeah. But at this point in time, he
was ready.
Came in ready to rock.
Yeah. So it was, that was a really, really good experience, and you know, and then Billy Amendola from Art and Drummer, when it was time to do Peter Criss's interview, he picked
me. Watch that.
Did you watch?
Yeah,
that was very cool.
Yeah, it's a really cool interview.
Yeah, so it was a good thing meeting those guys.
That's cool.
And getting to know them, you know, you see them and you're going, you see them at the, you know, in the early 70s and stuff, and then you end up like hanging. It's, mm-hmm. That's another thing about this business. Like a lot of times, you grow up as being a huge fan. Mark Farner comes to mind, Grand Funk. I went to see Grand Funk at the Fillmore, the first tour. Blew me away. Huge fan.
Yeah, they were great.
Don Brewer, the whole thing with a 3-piece band. It rocked.
Yeah.
And then I ended up playing with Mark Farner at the Fantasy Camps. And not only playing with Mark Farner, but I was his chosen drummer. He said to Fischdorf, I'm not doing a Fantasy Camp. I'm not playing there unless Kip Winger and Sandy Gennaro are in my rhythm section. So that became we became his default
That's
rhythm
great.
Section. So it was like it's a huge thrill for me.
Absolutely,
I'm
somebody
still
a fan of his. Yeah, that's a
and
great
then he
feeling.
Was at the last Dick Wagner thing in January. Mark Farner was
he was there.
He was a guest.
Oh, yeah.
He headlined the thing, and I brought Kip. Well, obviously, me and Kip played for Mark Farner, and I got Kip to be. I'm the one that brought Kip into this as a special guest at that last Dick Wagner benefit in Detroit.
Wow.
And so that was a great fun. It was great fun because a lot of times in those gigs, in the Dick Wagner gig, there's a lot of people on stage at the same time.
Yeah.
But everybody got cleared off. It was a 3-piece power trio.
That's awesome.
You know, foot stopping music all that stuff. It was just burning.
Oh yeah. When Grand Funk was at their peak, they were pretty much untouchable. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Show that Shea Stadium.
Yeah. That's one of the biggest bands in the world at the
time. I think in retrospect, they don't get the respect that they deserve.
No, they don't. They're never going to come up as often as they should.
Than most people remember Grand Funk to be.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's a shame, and I'm not going to go into what I know about the business there, but it's a shame that they're not a trio because they're still, Mark is still playing, very active, on top of his game. Don Brewer and the bass player Mel are very active, and they have a Grand Funk Railroad without Mark Farner with another singer, another guitar player,
Bruce Kulick.
Yeah. Right. When I saw them on a cruise, and they sounded really good, and they replicated the songs.
Yeah.
But what, you know, the business stands in the way. Again, I'm not going to get into it of them as a trio. You know what they can get now as an all-original Grand Funk Railroad?
Probably a lot more than they're getting right now.
Goodness gracious.
Well, that's just another reason why
that may,
Warriors
you know,
ruin
who
the
knows?
Business.
Stranger things have happened. I hope for Mark's sake that it happens because he deserves. He deserves.
It'd
He's
be cool
the writer,
to
the singer, and the guitar player. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Were you playing with Pat Travers when the Gibson 100th anniversary show happened here in Nashville in the early 90s?
No.
Oh, okay. I
was with him. My 2 times with Pat was December of 80 until like 83.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2010 to 2015.
Okay.
15, late 15, early 16, I think it was. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it was 15. I'm not sure, but I left the band at that point in time.
I was going to bring a vinyl. I picked up a vinyl Pat Travers album from the early 80s with you on it. And
Black Pearl or Radioactive. It was a cover.
It was a picture of you guys, I think, on the back, like in beach chairs or something.
That wasn't me.
I thought you
that,
were.
That was Heat in the Street.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
And that was in the late 70s, even before the live album.
Oh, okay.
And that was Tommy Aldridge and Pat Thrall. That was was a 4-piece band.
I'm not as schooled on Pat Travers as I am with Kiss.
I was going to say, you sure are good at doing that to drummers.
No kidding. Yeah, I did that to Eric Singer. I met him here at a Kiss convention, and I said how much I loved his drumming on the second Badlands album.
He wasn't.
That's funny. It wasn't me. I was like, oh, great. And I was like, well, I feel like a schmuck.
Chris does it again.
Yeah. We'll never live that one down. But, no, that's a trip. But, you did a lot of work with Pat Travers in the early 80s period. That's a pretty transitional time in music. So, were you doing some pretty memorable tours during that period?
Oh, yeah. We, We joined. When I joined the band, we immediately went in the studio and did Radioactive. Mm-hmm. And then we were like the perennial opening act for huge bands. Like we opened for Ted Nugent. The first tour I did was Rainbow with Blackmore.
Nice.
Blackmore, Roger Glover. It was like a Deep Purple kind of freshman.
Right.
Bobby Rondinelli, Long Island guy, friend of mine on drums. That was very cool. And Jolyn Turner was the singer.
Wow.
And then we did tours with Nugent. That's how I met Derek.
Yeah.
That was 81. Derek and Dave Casweeney. I'm still friends with those guys. They both live in here in Nashville. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a gig with them tomorrow in Paducah, Kentucky. Blue Oyster Cult, Heart,
yeah,
Aerosmith, when they had the replacement guitar.
Oh wow! What year was that?
Rick DeFay and
Jimmy Crespo.
Jimmy Crespo. Yeah. That was had to be like 82.
They were a mess at that point.
Yeah, I told them. It wasn't very pretty at all.
It's like, as much as I love the albums they did during that time, they were a dysfunctional mess at that point.
They were. That was. It's not a very pleasant.
Yeah, I've heard some stories about Steven like bringing concerts completely to a halt and just being a complete wreck on stage.
Yeah. So
it's amazing they came back from all that.
Bless their hearts, man. Yeah. They got to thank the Lord every day. They get out of bed, but they had the wherewithal or the advice, and they took the advice of cleaning up. And they cleaned up, came back, and they were bigger than ever.
Yeah, it's one of the best comeback stories of any band I've ever seen. Yeah.
But Travers, at that point in time, during those opening act tours and arenas, used to go do theaters and you know, whatever. He had his own little thing, and we toured constantly. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to join the band originally, because he had a reputation of being on the road all the time. And he was Polygram, and I was Polygram prior to that with Benny. Benny was on Polygram, and so was Blackjack. So the two bands prior to Travers was also, and that's how I heard about the impending firing of Tommy Aldridge, and that's why I went for the gig, because the A&R guy, I don't know if he wants to mention, but his name is Jerry Jaffe, called me and said, hey, I heard a rumor they want to get rid of Tommy, so go call this number. It's Pat's manager, David Hemmings, who's no longer with us, but I went to see David, gave me a cassette, and said, no, we're not planning on firing Tommy, but here's a cassette of the live show. So I went home and learned the 14 songs, and then about 2 months later, I got a call, go down to Florida and audition, and I did, and then rehearsed with them a few times down there, and did a live gig, and then he told me I was in the band. It was at the end of 1980.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So I was like one of those, should I tell anybody about this meeting? Who said we're having a meeting?
Right.
What meeting? Right?
Yeah. We didn't have a meeting.
Right.
All right, I got you. But so a lot of road dogging during those periods. Either you or Kirk told me this when we'd see each other out around shows about that you have this amazing collection of hotel keys.
Oh, it's right over there.
Well, explain how.
Well,
this
it's just, you know, stealing, or I would like to say borrowing, because everyone at hotels, they can have their key back if they called me. I'm just borrowing it. But, and three of them did call and say we want it back.
Really?
Yeah. So I had to send three keys back, but that's the only situation I had to send the key back. That was always, even before I was staying in hotels on behalf of bands, when I used to go on vacation with my family, that was my souvenir of choice, because they had the little plastic thing with the name of the hotel, the room number, and if found, place in every mailbox, whatever, and the city, the address, and all of that. So that was a perfect, it was the actual key to my room, or our room, or whatever. So that was my souvenir, and that continued through, you know, traveling, and then bands, obviously.
Yeah.
I kept every single hotel key I've ever had. And I'll show you guys.
You can't see it on
the podcast.
Yeah, but we'll get a picture before we leave. We'll put it up on a
That'll
show.
That'll be fine. And, so
every city you've gone to, you've saved it?
Everyone.
That's
Europe, Asia, South America. Now it's all basically in America, especially it's cards.
Yeah,
and in Europe now it's cards. But up until about 3 or 4 years ago, when you toured Europe, you got this big clunky ass key.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they have usually the older hotels in Europe. Now it's all like automated and stuff. But when you got into your room, you had to close the door, put the key in the door on the inside and turn the key, lock the door, and that's how it activated the electricity in the room.
Oh, okay.
So as a result of that, they put a big ass, like, not door connected to the key. It was a big, like, key thing with a rubber. So when it hit against the door, it wouldn't mark the door. The big, and it usually was a big metal thing with the name and the hotel and the room number and all that. So those were the holy grail. Those ones with, because it had the name of the city on it, or the name of the hotel in a different language, or in Japan. I have one that was a huge Krugerrand, like a like a huge coin, a Japanese coin or Chinese coin, whatever, like a replica.
Yeah,
and that was the key thing. So so when I lived on Staten Island before I moved to Nashville, I got a call saying, "Hey, a museum on Staten Island called Snug Harbor. Hey, we're going to do this retrospective on all the musicians from Staten Island that went on to do really big things in the music business. Can we come over and interview you? And maybe we can borrow some artifacts, like a snare drum you played on a hit or whatever." I said, "Sure." So they came over to my house, interviewed me, took the snare drum and whatever, and took some pictures. And I said, I don't know what you're going to do with this. They were on their way out. And I said, I got this collection, and they're in these potato chip tins, as you can see.
Yeah.
And I said, I got nowhere. They were in the tins. I have no way to display these because they're all different.
Right.
So I said, "Well, I don't know what you're going to do with these, but I have this collection." And they went, they freaked out. They said, "Can we have those? That's awesome." So they took the three potato chip tins, and they emailed me, and they said they found a table in the basement of that museum loaned to them from the Smithsonian, where the Smithsonian used to display fossils.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And perfect is right. Yeah. It was like a waist high table, glass. It was, and it had legs that are waist high, but the table itself was maybe 8 to 10 inches high, all glass around the sides, with a glass top that opened.
That's
so
perfect.
You can walk around, you could see inside the thing, and they just dumped the keys. I said, "How many, what was it?" He goes, "We stopped counting at 2,500.
Wow.
We stopped counting.
So you don't have a total number of them.
No, I don't have a total. But now they're in this table in a show, right in the lobby of the museum. Like, it was the showcase piece, and it had the little thing. I can show you the little plaque they put on the table describing the collection or whatever. And I took some pictures. I can show you pictures. And so after that was a year-long loan that I let them go. And then when I time to pick them up, they put them back in the tins. And I said, "How much do you want for that table? Because now I got a place to display these."
Absolutely.
Table. Perfect. Yeah. Let me check with my supervisor. It turned out that because it was a gift from the Smithsonian Institute, they didn't want to let it go.
Oh, that's a bummer.
So now they're back in the tins, and I'm looking. I'm kind of like in the back of my mind. I'm looking for like a used aquarium or a terrarium.
That's where Craigslist comes in.
I know.
You can probably find
I'm going to display them at some point. Now, touring America, I always make a habit of writing my room number on my plastic Ving card, or whatever they call it. And so I still keep the cards. Even.
Okay, I just hope that the revealing this on our show isn't going to cause some class action lawsuit from the hotels.
No, it's not. It's not going to. I always figured out I had very creative ways of getting. I might as well say it. Sometimes it came down to me actually stealing.
Yeah.
Well, it was always stealing, but it was, sometimes I would say, "Hey, I left my key when I was on my way out to the gig."
Yeah,
can I get a spare key? Yeah. I left it in. I'm in no hurry. I can't. So they would give me a spare key, and then when I checked out, "Oh, did you leave your key?" "Yep, here it is."
Yep.
Yeah.
I would leave them the spare and keep the original. So that was one way. Another way, when they would say, "No, we'll let you back in," we'll let you into your room. So normally they would have security, or somebody would come and let me into my room to get the spare key, or they would say, "When you come back to the hotel after your show, we'll let you into your room." Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't have a spare key. So in that case, I would either just steal the key, or I would wait till nobody in these European hotels, sometimes after 11 o'clock, there's no front desk personnel anymore. Mm-hmm. I would sneak behind, and they had the little slots behind with the room number.
Oh, you're bad.
All right. I would actually actually, but that was
that's commitment that's, to the collection.
That is commitment to the cause.
It has to go in, especially if it was a big ornate key.
Right?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my hotel key story.
That's amazing.
Well, let's get into blackjack. Because we played a song last week on the last week's episode. We played Love Me Tonight from it.
Oh, cool.
But my main exposure to blackjack is from this video that got put on YouTube a couple of years ago where it was like a press kit type video.
Let me tell you a little story about that video.
Yeah.
When we did that video, 1979, mm-hmm. we did a studio. Polygram paid because we had Steve Weiss handling us, who was Led Zeppelin's attorney. He was our attorney. So he had a lot of clout. So we got the funding to do two videos, one on the roof of Polygram with the helicopter coming in with the mm-hmm. outro and intro or whatever, and a studio video of Love Me Tonight.
Yeah.
And on the roof it was Live Without Your Love, the song.
Like that.
And we did the video. They compiled the two videos, and then in between they interviewed Tom Dowd, our producer. I loved him. Like, he was my musical father.
Yeah,
he was
amazing.
Still to this day, I use what he's taught me 35 years ago on the drum set. He was like my dad. He was awesome. But anyway, so they interviewed Tom Dowd, Dickie Klein, who was Polygram vice president, Freddie Hyam, and whatever, as hyping. And that video was meant to send to Europe to play, to get European Polygram to show them what their priority was in terms of, you know, and maybe show a video on TV in Europe or whatever.
Yeah.
So I, like the hotel keys, everything I'm involved, every video I'm involved in, whether I'm in the band or a side man or whatever, I get a copy of it. Mm-hmm. And I got a copy of it, a VHS copy of it. So 30 years, well, maybe 25 years go by. Let's call it 95 and 2000. Bruce, I see Bruce Kuehler. Hey, Sammy, I know you save everything, man. He goes, I'd like to see that blackjack video. I go, Bruce, then don't let it out of your sight. I mean, it's a VHS. So I made a copy of the VHS, sent it to him. Mm-hmm. About 4 days later, I start getting emails from people, like fans of mine or something, or friends of mine from Scotland. Hey, I saw the blackjack. It went, not viral, but it went online.
I remember when it came out,
I'm going, Bruce, what the... He goes, man, I'm sorry, Sandy, but I gave it to my web guy to put it on my website.
Well, once you do that,
I'm not sure how, but anyway, the guy put it, he made it available online.
So I don't remember. Just make a copy, but he ended up putting it online.
Right. But once it's on a website, then it can be shipped.
It can be captured. All right, it can be captured
anyway,
and then put on
he
YouTube.
Ended up putting it on his website. Oh. That's what it was.
Oh, yeah.
And it went, so whatever. So it was like...
Well, as a fan, I liked it.
Yeah. So it was cool. I mean, and so that's where the video...
That's
how it ended up online. It wasn't online since 1980, obviously.
Yeah.
That was a good. It was my first foray into professional rock and roll. It was my first album deal, and it was a band situation, and it had a lot of potential, that gig. But
it's a good band. All good players.
Yeah. How'd you get recruited for that?
That's kind of a story. I moved to LA. I told you I lived in LA in the late 70s, and I became very good friends with a hero drummer of mine, Carmine Appice, the Vanilla Fudge. And I went to see his clinic when he was in the Fudge. I would just started playing drums. He was always my hero, whatever. And then I moved to LA, and I met Carmine at a party, and I reminisced with him about the clinic and Kings Highway in Brooklyn and whatever. And I asked him if I could use him as a reference, because I was in LA before I did anything famous, trying to get my first big break. And he said, well, I can't really recommend you until I hear you play. So I ended up getting this a few weeks later or whatever. I ended up getting this gig with Steppenwolf, one original member. Goldie McJohn was the original keyboard player, and he put his Steppenwolf band around himself. And God rest his soul, Goldie just passed away a few weeks ago. So I was in rehearsing with Steppenwolf at SIR in LA, and Carmine happened to be there rehearsing with one of his projects. And I said, "Hey, Carmine, how you doing? Come in and hear me play." So he heard me play. He goes, "Sandy, you could use my name as a reference." Awesome. Awesome. So things were happening in LA, or I should say they weren't happening in LA. It's a long story. My first marriage was falling apart. I was broke. I was wanting to quit the music business. I wanted to move back to New York and all of this stuff. And there was a voice inside me that said, "Keep going."
Yeah.
First of all, you know that's what you want to do, and you spent all this time, you moved 3,000 miles to do it, keep going. And another voice has said, "Well, if you stop, what are you going to do? Are you going to work in a record store? What are you going to do? Are you going to bag groceries? What are you going to do?" I kept going. So I went to the library. Billboard magazine put this talent management directory out once a year. I got the talent management directory, and I made note of the addresses of 50 managers that managed bands that I really liked. Not the fact that I was going to get a gig with one of them, but maybe they know somebody, or maybe they have another band that's in the same musical style.
Right.
So I sent the 50 resumes out, and the resume consisted of my hard copy of me and my drum set, a photo stapled on the front page of this 8 by 8.5 by 11, and inside was typewritten, the lessons I took, but the reference was one, Carmine Appice.
Yeah.
Sent it out to 50 managers. Nobody called me back except Steve Weiss, Led Zeppelin's attorney. Now, the thing is, the serendipitous thing here is, and that's why I believe in a universe, and I believe that things happen for a reason if you keep going, and you knock on the door and it'll be open. Well, I was fucking knocking on this this career door, and no one called me back, as I said, but Steve, and the resume was addressed to Peter Grant, who's the manager of Led Zeppelin, based in England.
Right.
But the address in the Billboard directory said 444 Madison Avenue, New York, New York, 10016. It was care of Swan Song Records. And Peter Grant, care of Swan Song Records, the New York address. So that's where I sent it. It never got forwarded to England. Steve Weiss, who ran the label and was their attorney, opened up the resume. Right at that period of time, he was shopping a cassette of songs written and played on by and sang by Michael Bolton, or Bolotin at that point, and Bruce Kulick, with a session bass player and drummer. He was shopping this yet unnamed band around to the different label presidents. Oh. Not the A&R people, the presidents of the labels.
Right
around this time, my resume arrives at Swan Song. He doesn't forward it to Peter Grant. He opens up the resume and goes, "Oh, I'm looking for a drummer right now. This is a drummer. Who's this guy, Sandy Gennaro?" The punchline of this story is he goes to the second page and sees my reference and sees Carmine Appice's name there. And Steve Weiss used to handle the Vanilla Fudge, which was Carmine's former band years earlier.
Awesome.
I'm going, what kind of synchronicity is this? So he calls me. The only guy out of 50 managers that even returned or called me in Los Angeles was Steve Weiss. "Hey, Sandy, it's Steve Weiss. I'm the attorney for Led Zeppelin. You motherfucker, if you're somebody from L.A. playing this joke on me," because that's the way sometimes people in L.A. are.
Right.
"Oh, no, Sandy, no. You sent the resume to Peter Grant, blah, blah, blah. I'm the attorney." "Oh, sorry, Steve. Right. What can I do for you?" "Well," and he explained the story. "He's looking for a drummer. We need a bass player and a drummer. Would you want to come to New York to audition?" I got a high referral from Carmine.
Yeah, right.
Flew to New York, got the gig. Right at that time, they flew in Jimmy Haslett.
Yeah.
He was on the road with Tom Scott at the time. So we rehearsed for a couple of days, 5 songs. And then maybe 3 or 4 days later, we auditioned for Polygram. Well, we auditioned for a bunch of labels.
Yeah.
And Polygram was the highest bidder. And we ended up getting, long story condensed, we ended up getting signed to Polygram. And then a couple of weeks after that, we auditioned for Tom Dowd.
Wow.
And Tom Dowd doesn't produce new bands.
No.
I'm not going to go into Tom Dowd's resume, but
it's
Google
impressive.
Tom Dowd, D-O-W-D. Right.
It's also a great documentary about him,
too. Oh, it was an awesome documentary.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. Yeah.
Awesome documentary. And I'm friends with his daughter, Dana Dowd, Facebook.
Yeah.
So he produced the record. And I'm going to myself, I'm sitting in Criteria Studios in Miami. Tom Dowd's behind the desk. I'm there, and the red light's on. I'm going, man, four months ago, I was about to throw the sticks in the fireplace.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lesson there where if you have your goal in mind, just, you know, obstacles are put in front of you to allow you to learn. Mm-hmm. And obstacles are put in front of you by the universe to test how bad you want what's on the other side of that obstacle. And that's my theory.
Yeah.
So you just, if you have something, a goal in mind, mm-hmm. just go for it. Go for it, regardless of what happens, man. You go over the obstacle and the side of it, under it, but when you come out on the other side, you're even stronger because you learned from that obstacle.
Right. Right?
So that's happened. And we had a guaranteed 2-album deal. We toured with Peter Frampton for a little while in support of that first record. And did a second record up in Woodstock at LeBron Helm Studio with Eddie Offord, quote-unquote, producing it. He was kind of an absentee producer. Bruce and Michael basically produced that second record. The Blackjack record was called Worlds Apart.
Right.
And then from there, rehearsing with Blackjack, I ended up getting tapped on the shoulder by Benny Mardones, heard me rehearse with Blackjack at the rehearsal studio and asked me to play on his record, mm-hmm. which Into the Night came off of that record, which is one of the biggest hits I ever played.
That's a big hit.
So that was the beginning of the dominoes falling, wow. And then one gig led to the next, that's the way it is. That, when you think positive and you have a goal in mind, mm-hmm. You might be thrown off that path to do different things from unexpected situations and stuff that occur.
Yeah.
But the dominoes will fall.
Yeah.
And after I get off of one tour, I don't know when the next tour is going to come, but I get the call. Well, I saw you with this. Whatever. It's a very interesting, what I call 1099 world. The freelance musician world is a very interesting thing, man. It's like,
yeah, there's nothing like it.
It's like only the strong survive.
Yeah,
basically,
absolutely.
Because if you're weak-willed or you have any kind of doubt about your ability, and it's not an ego.
No.
It's a quiet, it's a confidence.
Yeah,
and
right.
The confidence comes from being prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you have that confidence in you, and you just got to keep going regardless of what happens.
Yeah. And Blackjack was loaded with great players, all of you. I mean, and you all went on to do great stuff.
Yeah.
And it's pretty impressive how well it turned out for all four of you guys.
It sure did.
And there's a Kiss connection to all four of you. Like, you did the thing with Peter.
Right.
Bruce wound up in Kiss.
Right.
Michael wrote Forever with Paul Stanley for Kiss, which was one of their biggest hits.
That's right.
And Jimmy ghosted for Gene Simmons on Creatures of the Night.
That I didn't know.
Yeah.
That
he plays
I didn't
that.
Know.
He plays on at least a handful of the tracks on Creatures of the Night.
Wow.
Yeah.
And who was on that record? Was Eric? Was that
Eric Carr was in the band, and Vinnie Vincent had taken over for Ace Frehley.
I didn't know that Jimmy played on those songs.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's the bassist on a number of those tracks. So yeah,
that's awesome.
There's a Kiss connection. We can find a Kiss connection.
Right, yeah.
That's what you say. It's so huge in the Kiss world. Somewhere, everything's
there. It is.
Well, and they've been around so long; they're connected to everybody.
Right.
I'm convinced. But
last week we played that Blackjack song, and Chris made a big deal about we're breaking the Bolton barrier, and because Michael Bolton for Rock and Rollers isn't usually looked on.
Well, you don't think of him when you think of hard rock. Yeah,
but when you look back at that early Blackjack stuff, and even those first couple of solo albums he came out with, he had a very David Coverdale kind of Robert Plant-ish image style
very much
going on. He was
in that first Blackjack album. Reviewers regarded him as like a Seeger Rod Stewart kind of guy.
Yeah,
and that was an awesome experience. And the thing that stands out about that Blackjack experience is my association with Tom Dowd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It takes my breath away when I think about it. And being a band member, I could stay at Criteria. And after my basic tracks were done, I stood through the overdubs, through the vocals, through the mix. I was just a fly in the wall, man, because I knew this guy was a fountain of musical knowledge. And the way he got Bruce to play certain parts, I was in the control room, so I heard the little banter between the control Tom and the engineer and whatever. But how he had the producer's psychology down to a pat. He had an idea of what he wanted us to play, but he would bring it out of us. He wouldn't dictate to us the part. Mm-hmm. He would somehow do like a little, oh, you're getting warmer. Yeah. You're getting warmer, that kind of game. Yeah. And then when we hit it, he would go, you're freaking awesome, Sandy. Bruce, that was awesome. What a great intro. That was the one I suggested earlier. He would tell the engineer. So he would get the Bruce, let's say, to play a part that
there's
that
a psychology to it.
Oh man. Yeah. And Bruce would go, oh, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
He would, you know, that would bolster his confidence in himself and, right, and sure, myself being right. the first thing that I ever did, and I'm setting the criteria.
Yeah, and that's
like, and pretty intimidating, just the scenario. Yeah. Man, it was like, it was just, it was awesome. It was I'm very, very fortunate to have that. And as I said, I still listen to Tom Zaw's voice in my head when I'm playing.
I didn't know much about him until I saw the documentary on him. It just happened to come on TV one day, and I DVR'd it, and I must have watched it 10 times. I mean, it's just fascinating.
I have it on DVD. I haven't watched it in a long time, but I'll tell you what, during that session, we had like a 12-9 schedule every day, noon to 9, and we used to take a dinner break and go out. He never had dinner brought in. We used to go out to a restaurant and have it. So we're sitting in a social, and he would have the stories, and the stories that Tom Dowd would tell, man.
Yeah.
From, you know, Ahmed Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, and when he was the engineer for those guys.
Yeah, he was on the ground floor of all of it.
Aretha, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, all those guys, early Atlantic stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had like 3, 4, 5 weeks of nightly dinners with this man. Yeah. But is when I put the DVD on, his documentary, I learned stuff that I've never heard.
Yeah.
Like, in other words, I heard so much more than he was even...
That's crazy.
In 5 weeks of dinners,
right.
I found out stuff that I never knew about the guy.
That's amazing.
You know?
Well, the stuff with like the bomb testing and all that.
The
from
Secret
early
City and
yeah,
all that
Yeah, I was
shit.
Like, oh my God, it's
he
not
didn't
just...
speak about it. He didn't. Yeah. He alluded to it. He was, I used to be a physicist or something.
Yeah.
But he never spoke in detail about it. I didn't think he felt really good about being part of it.
Oh, no, you could tell he didn't. But it just when I saw that in the movie, I was like, wow, can imagine starting from that and then going on to all this rock and roll history. And just,
you know, on Facebook, it was about a year ago, I have it here. You can't see it on the podcast, but I have it here. It might be upstairs, but it was the track sheet. It was a tape box from Criteria, the Blackjack track sheet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, and I took a picture of the track sheet and I posted it on Instagram. And Dana Dowd, the daughter, oh, Sandy, awesome! And that kind of went viral on Facebook.
Yeah.
It was the actual track sheet from that session.
With Tom's writing and everything.
I don't know if it was Tom's writing, but it had Tom Dowd. It was the engineer probably, but it had all the specifics of the episode. It was awesome.
That's cool.
Well, now on paper, I see Blackjack is a band that should have went to the top, you know, on paper as far as like the musicians and the songwriting and everything. But you had a trajectory with that band that only went so far before Bolton ended up becoming Michael Bolton. What went wrong, do you think?
Well, I always wondered that same thing. Yeah. And it wasn't that the band broke up because Michael wanted to go to solo. The band didn't happen. The first album, and the story I got from various A&R people at Polygram that worked that record was that if they were to put that, because it was the top priority of Polygram in 79, it was hyped a lot. And everybody on the Polygram roster was put on the back burner because all the promotion department was given the edict from the president. This is the priority project for this record, for this year.
Wow.
And the first Blackjack record. And in addition to that, they hired a bunch of independent promotion people. So, trying to get it played on the radio. The story I got from several A&R guys was that if they put out that record, like a normal record, it would have went further than it would. Because it was hyped so much when they... program directors put it on, they were expecting the best thing since White Bread.
Right.
But it was good, but it wasn't, it didn't fulfill the hype, in other words.
Right.
And that basically, you know, it tried to, Love Me Tonight was the first single, it caught fire a little bit, but and then Run Out Your Love was the second single, but it didn't sell as what they expected.
Yeah.
And with the video and all the tour support, all the upfront recoupable finances that we had gotten from Polygram, we had to go gold. I think we had to go sell 500,000 copies before the band even made a penny.
Wow.
But that was one of the only situations where I was an equal band member.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, I got a view of that part of the business, being an equal partner in a band, which is kind of cool.
But the band gelled good personality-wise?
The band gelled good personality-wise. As I said, for the second record, we did it at Polygram, and basically the Polygram's disposition during that second record was just to fulfill the contract.
It was like, we gave it a shot, now
there
we're just going to be done with
so this. Yeah. You go to Woodstock, do what you need to do, and again, Eddie Offord was an absentee kind of producer, so you know, Bruce and Michael basically produced that second record, and once that came out, we never really toured and supported that second record.
Well, so didn't have much of a
chance,
so
it just kind of dissolved. Then they didn't pick up the option, Polygram, for a third record. We had a seven album deal, but only two were guaranteed.
Right.
So for the third album, they dropped the band. When they dropped the band, then Michael went with Columbia and got his own deal. And then I think Bruce played on that first Michael Bone solo record.
Yeah, he did.
So that's basically it. You know, if it became successful, we might be still together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because we're all still playing.
Yeah.
And singing. And so if we had reason to stay together, we might have, because we all got along really good. And you know, there was no issues personality-wise in the band. Mm. We were all very happy with our positions in there, and we were all given opportunities to submit songs. I was given opportunities to submit lyrics. So it was all a very kind of democratic thing.
Right.
Bruce and Michael were the principal writers.
They were.
And Michael was a singer.
Yeah.
But, you know...
What is Jimmy up to these days? I haven't heard much about him.
I'm not really sure. I know he was with the Yellow Jackets for a long time. He was the musical director for that. It was like a jazz thing. I think he's probably doing sessions and stuff in Los Angeles. He's based in L.A. now, and originally from Long Island. Mm. And we kind of email every once in a while, but I haven't seen him in a really long time.
Well, let's not forget the most fun part of Blackjack was Jimmy and Bruce both had incredible mustaches.
It was a Spinal Tap situation.
Yeah.
You know, on that second Blackjack album, that's right on there on the wall there, you see upper right, lower left, it was like me. It's like, yeah, it kind of looked a little bit like Spinal Tap.
Bruce changed a lot from Blackjack to Kiss.
He did.
Oh man! Well, this has been fun. We want to we do an Albums Unleashed series. I'd like to sit down with you another time and maybe do the first Blackjack album, like track by track.
Oh,
discussion.
That'd be great! Cool. I'd love to. I'd love to do that.
Because a few times I've mentioned that I've met you and that you live here. They're like, oh, you got to get him to do that Blackjack.
Yeah.
One.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
you're gonna be appearing, if you're hearing this the week of release, you're going to be one of the guests at the Rockin' Pod Expo we have going next weekend.
I'll be there Friday night playing with some friends of mine that we do a tribute to Bad Company and Paul Rodgers.
Yep.
That'll be Friday night at
the Cobra in East Nashville.
The Cobra.
Yeah.
And then Saturday I'll be at the Rockin' Pod, which will be at...
That's at Music Valley Event Center. It's over by Opry Mills.
And... That's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope to see you all. I'll be up there in a booth signing some stuff. And
so you'll sign a few Blackjack albums while you're there.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Maybe a Monkey album or two.
And there's a Monkeys podcast that's looking forward to talking to
you. Yeah.
Well, thanks for doing this.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.